Okay, thank you all for coming, first of all. About the format of the talk, this is not a formal presentation. I will tell you about the work that I'm doing now, more or less. So it's the first time I'm giving this presentation in a big room. Huh?
Move your computer away from the...
No, that's on purpose I put it here. So the way I wanted to do it is the following. I have a theoretical part and some experiments. And the theoretical part I decided to present on the blackboard like Bill did it. So I will not need this for most part of my talk. But as opposed to Bill, I also have some experiments to show. So I will then take this to the side. So I'll talk about first of all, neural network models of learning and memory, and more specifically, for me, it goes by the name of Hopfield model, but it actually has some history before Hopfield. And this is the sort of high-level theory, right? It's trying to understand really some computational designs of the brain. So that's maybe it's a bit different. This talk will be a bit different than what you heard. Than all the previous talks, which were mostly dealing with the issues like encoding and information theory, et cetera. This is really a very long shot. You try to come up with one unifying theory that would explain a lot about how the brain works. Not everything, but learning and memory, which is, of course, a big part of what the brain is doing. So like any model of the memory, in my view, it should explain at least, at the very least, several things. So first, it has to put, you know, how the memories are represented in the brain and what form they're represented. So it's a representation. Then the second issue is how they're actually stored in the brain. What is the trace? So it's storage. And of course, it will be completely useful if this cannot be retrieved in the time of the need. So the next issue is the retrieval. And actually, if you think a little bit about it, it should be retrieved in a way which is useful in some sense. So it has to be retrieved in a way that is useful for doing something with this memory. And for example, it has to stay in the active state for some time, even when the cues that led to the retrieval are gone. So you can think about, you know, just remembering something just for the immediate duration of that is needed for performing a certain task. So I would say some persistence. Well, there are many more, you know, features and attributes of the memory, but this is the very least that should explain the biological memory. So the way, you know, Hopfield model neural networks go about, you know, representing all these things is the following. So, of course, in a rather maybe simplistic way. So you say, first of all, the memories are represented as certain patterns of activity in the dedicated network. So you have a special, you need to have a special place in the brain, a special network, which is responsible for this long, this is all, you know, long-term memory. For long-term memories, and every memory, everything that you want to memorize is represented there as some pattern of activity. So if you have a network of N neurons, and you want to remember P things or P items, you represent each of the memory by a vector of activities in this n-dimensional space. You say it's psi I mu.
Can I ask to what extent it's actually known or not known this is the way a memory works?
I'll tell you something about, you know, relation to the experiment. You know, I think it's a little bit better if I just present this. This will take me like 5, 10 minutes just to cover all this, and then we can discuss, you know, big part of my talk will be actually the relation to the experiments. Okay, so these are the levels of activities, and, you know, and this can be represented, let's say, by firing rates of this neuron, so even more simplistically by numbers, which is 0, 1, so plus, originally it was taken to be plus minus ones to emphasize the analogy with some physical system. Okay, so how these memories or these activity states are stored in the network? By the following way. So the network is a dynamical system, right? If you let it run, it will just evolve. These activities will change. So to say that a certain state is a memory, the idea is that you have to prepare the network in such a way that this state will be a stable state of the network, right? So the storage is, now how to do it is obviously by changing the connection strength between the neurons. So the storage is preparing the connection strength between the neurons in such a way that this memory that you want to remember will be a steady state or fixed stable states in the network, so that they can persist for some time. Okay, and the way Hopfield proposed to do it is just to say that Jij is just is a correlation matrix of this pattern. So it's 1 over n, sum over mu, from 1 to p, psi I mu, psi j. Okay, so then what is the retrieval? The retrieval is, you know, after this is done, there is still no, doesn't have to be any activity in the network. So all we did is that we left in the network the trace about this memory. They're now represented in the strength of these connections. So in order to retrieve a certain memory, you need to provide a certain cue. So for example, you can present this pattern as an input to the network, or a certain part of, you know, sort of degraded version of this. And then the retrieval is the intrinsic process when the network, by means of its dynamic, will reconstruct exactly this activity state. And this is done by the by intrinsic dynamics of the network. And again, this can be realized, of course, on many different levels of complexity. The simplest way, which was, again, in the original Hopfield model, is that you consider neurons as a spins of magnetic spins, which have just two states, plus or minus one spin going up or down. So at every moment in time, you have S I of t, which is plus minus one. And the state of this spin on neuron at time t is given by, you first have to calculate the total input that this neuron receives from all other neurons, and then you take a sine function. Okay, so if the total input that this neuron receives is positive or excitatory, the neuron goes into the active state, otherwise goes into the down state. So this is realized by these dynamics. Okay, and then if this guarantees that all the memory states are stable states, so the attractors of these dynamics, then even if you begin set initial condition as some randomized or degraded version of this memory by means of this internal dynamics, this will converge into the pure memory state. So this will be a process of retrieval. And resistance is sort of automatically guaranteed, because since this is the attractor state, you can then give the network some time, even without the cue that led to the retrieval of this memory. It will remain for some time, you know, until there is some noise process or other inputs will move the network to some other states. But if there is no disturbances, this can stay in this state. Okay, so this is a very short introduction to the Hopfield model. If you have any questions here, ask them, because then I just move to some other things. Yes.
I have, I think, elementary confusions, but nevertheless, okay. Many points that I have never understood about this. So for example, if I want to store two memories,
yes,
then you would presumably say that I choose some other state. Well, Hopfield would say that I choose some other stable state of the network. But then what's never been clear to me is exactly how I'm supposed to piece apart exactly what those two different memories were. They seem to be this kind of language will always be confounded, right? If you want to say that n things, n memories are stored in some other stable state, then how do you piece apart which of those n memories do you want in this language of retrieval, right?
You need to provide a certain cue. If you have n like p memories stored, right? So every of these memories is a stable state. In order to retrieve a particular one, you have to provide a certain cue. So as I said, it could be partial information about this memory, or a memory with some mistakes maybe, And then this will provide the guidance to the network into which attractor to fall. If you just let it run, you know, under the influence of noise, it will presumably fall randomly in one of the memories that are there. But clearly, in order to select the memory, you know, when you try to recall something, you have some information which is guiding you. So it's called, sometimes it goes by the name retrieval by content, right? You need to provide the partial content. You don't need to say, you know, where this memory is stored or what are precisely these psis. You provide the partial content, and then if this works well, it will just complete what's missing in the reconstruct.
I think there's small confusion here,
yeah,
between what you call active memory, and which is really the activity, the current
yes.
activity of the network, and the storage, the memory, which is actually in the connection, it's not in the dynamics.
Right.
And the learning is really changing the connections, and of course,
yeah.
connections can store more than one pattern,
right?
Which can be active
yeah.
at different times.
So yeah, if there was, I think that's what I said, but maybe you know.
That's storage of the
I didn't say this.
A bit confusing in that sense, because there is really two senses, at least two senses of memory here, and learning is actually related to the dynamics of the J's and so on.
Right, storage is learning. Yeah.
So it's both short-term memory. Short-term memory is activity.
Right, so this persistence guarantees that you have some short-term memory. So if you activated the memory, it can stay without any support, right? You don't need to always provide the input that retrieved it.
Well, the short-term memory for the things that you've already learned.
Right, this is a short-term memory for the things that are already in your long-term memory. There might be other mechanisms of the short-term memory that don't require this, right? You can see a new picture completely and still remember it for something. Say it again?
Presumably all of the things are usually called short-term memory. Right?
Well, in the experiment that...
short-term memory, they usually don't right. mean the thing...
They don't mean the short-term memory for the... I don't know.
Well, they call it actually working with memory
yeah.
now.
Right.
So short-term memory is not a term that's commonly used. In working memory, can be either...
Yes.
Well, the issue is, can you really remember things that are completely new to you? And that's an issue. No, I agree that in the you can set up in the experiment that you can remember for some time things that you didn't explicitly represent here, but maybe they are combinations of the things. You cannot remember white noise pattern, so it's the relation is not very clear. Okay.
So we know from a lot of research and false memories and memory literature that associations can play an important part.
Yeah, that's my talk about.
It's often just sort of a small part. I mean, a lot of this, a lot of memory is very interpretive and can be affected by all sorts of biases.
Right, right.
Is that part of this?
Right. Well, that's more or less what I want to talk about. How this thing, you know, this thing is clearly very, very simplistic, and the main thing here is that this procedure works well if these patterns are random and uncorrelated. There is no relation between them. Then you can really show that this procedure works. So if you prepare these vectors as a random patterns, no correlations between them, then you can really prove that this recipe actually works, that every pattern will become a stable state of the network. Okay? Because the way, to understand is that, the simplest way to understand is the following. So imagine you have this matrix and your initial state is certain S, right, which is not, doesn't coincide with any memories. And then you want to see what will be the state of the network at the next step, right? So if you put it, so what is the sum over J, Jij as J? Okay, this is what is the input that every neuron I receives. So if you put this construction here, what you get is 1 over N, sum over mu, psi I mu, sum over J, psi J mu, S J. Okay, so this thing, if I put 1 over N here, is usually called overlap. This tells how close the initial state is to the memory number mu. Okay, so you can write it as sum over mu, psi I mu, and mu. Okay, now the reason this thing works for random patterns is that if you prepare the network in a state that has partial overlap with one of the memory, let's say for one of the memories, this number is on the order of one. Right? It is a number that is defined such that it is one only of these identical patterns. But let's say this is on the order of one. Now, since this, if these patterns are uncorrelated, all the other overlaps will be on the order of one over square root of n, let's say. Right? So you have m, which is, if this is mu, you'll have a big value for one particular pattern, and then random overlaps with all other patterns. So if you can neglect this other overlap, so you will have just one term here. Okay, so it means that at the next step, when you just have to take a sign of this, you'll reconstruct the pattern number mu. Okay, this is the reason why this idea works in case that the patterns are uncorrelated. If the patterns are correlated, you will have other overlaps here, right? Because if you have a state which is similar to one of the memories, and the memories themselves are similar to each other, some correlation between them, you'll have a lot of other spurious overlaps. So there will be another terms here, which for the retrieval of this memory will be just a noise, right? Because it will create other terms here which are proportional to all other memories that you don't want to retrieve. And so the moment you introduce some correlations, you have a problem here that you have this interference between the other memories. So it's very difficult to retrieve in the memory that you want to retrieve because you automatically involve inputs coming from all other memories. And this is, of course, the problem of this idea, because clearly, you know, we are not only remembering the isolated facts, but we are remembering them in certain contexts, sort of associations between them. So it's not clear how to represent this. Okay, so maybe I show you, because there was a question about whether it has any experimental support. So let me show you one picture that shows that some of this is actually supported. So this is the experiment. The classical experiment, memory experiment in monkeys is delayed sample to match task. So the monkey is seeing a certain picture, then there is a delay period, and then it sees another picture, it has to say if it's the same or not. So delay, it's matched to sample task. And if these pictures are familiar, so if the monkey was seeing these pictures during the time when it was trained for the task, so you can find you can find neurons in the IT areas here, which have this persistent, what they call persistent activity. So it's a neuron which has a very low spontaneous rate. It responds to the picture when it's presented. But then when it's removed, so for this delay period, it still fires with a rate that is much higher than spontaneous rate. Okay, now this is selective, so it's not doing it for every picture, doing only for a very specific subset of picture that the monkey is familiar with. So, you know, if you present another picture, this neuron may respond, but the spontaneous rate will be almost indistinguishable from this one.
What's the maximum delay for which this?
So in this experiment, it was 16 seconds, which is very long for on the neuronal time scale. It's very long.
But it stays on for that period, 16 seconds.
No, the picture is removed.
No, I understand, but
this activity, well, that's what you see here. Right?
Do you know what the maximum delay would be?
I don't know. I don't know. Okay, so the interpretation is that these neurons, if you would imagine that you could record from many neurons simultaneously, you would find that some small subset of them will carry the information about the picture that was presented during this period, and then this information is presumably used when the second picture is presented to compare, you know, the picture, the information that is coming from the second picture with this memory that is lasting from the first position. Yeah.
Is the delay period activity slowly, gently decaying, or is it more like it just stochastically switches off if you wait long enough at some point? You know, is there some?
You know, I never had an access to the raw data here, so I cannot really say. I only, you know, all I know is this accidental pictures from the Nature paper, so I don't really, could never, you know, have a. This is done by Miyashita, by the way.
The difference between left and right is that on the left, the monkey was trained to recognize the picture.
No, just another picture. This is the response to one picture, this is the response to another.
So the monkey wasn't trained for either.
No, no, all these pictures are familiar. So the monkey's seen them for months and months when it was trying.
Except for the one on the right.
No,
all of them, all of them.
So what is the difference between right and...
This is just one picture, that's another picture. So the point here is that the neuron is, this particular neuron contributes to the memory for this picture, not for that one. You can do some statistics and you come up. There is someone, right. Yes, I agree. But you could say that this is some, you know, non-specific increase in the spontaneous rate. Because there is a clear, you know, presumably there is a bimodal distribution and...
But to be fair, this experiment is consistent with many other models, not only with the open model.
We can argue about it. I actually don't believe so.
So,
for example, I don't know, something like a synthetic chain or something like that. Any collective activity which you present, not necessarily this particular symmetric dynamics of, I don't see this as a proof of the Hopkin model.
Hopkin model, you just mean a tractor picture?
Yeah, tractor, well, no, that.
You mean bistable?
The statement that activity represents memories is hard to argue with, it's too general.
Yeah.
Now, that learning is in the connectivity is also, I think, hard to argue. But what exactly is the correct dynamics?
I don't see how thin fire chain would be compatible. Thin fire chain was actually part of the motivation for this was to explain how can you have this short-term memory without persistent elevation of the firing. Because the neuron only fires once when the thin fire, when the wave goes through this layer where it's located, and just emits one spike.
No.
Unless you assume that this is continuous, yeah, you know.
Reverberation. Maybe it's reverberation. The same thing. Heinz Sokolinsky said that there's no big difference in that sense between
them.
Okay. But I mean, I guess to take the issues apart, right, the observation of persistent activity tells you essentially that it's plausible to think that your short-term sort of working memory for the thing you were shown is being represented by activity of these neurons.
Right.
But exactly what it is in the dynamics that maintains that activity.
Right, of course, yes. That's
what
we will not know from the recording.
Well,
showing that
it's a network effect and not be.
Right, that's also not so.
It's common to say that seconds is a long time scale on the time scale of neurons. As the joke goes, every once in a while it's worth remembering that neurons are cells.
Right. There are, yes.
A second is not a long time.
Right. There are recent observations that actually single neurons can maintain their rate for seconds. So there are clearly. I will show one more slide which goes towards some more evidence that this is a network effect. But I will first want to.
Shouldn't the demonstration that it's activity like this that maintains shorter memory also require that we have unfamiliar images?
The claim is that for the unfamiliar images you don't see this. That's
so
a clear.
How do we remember those?
Very good question. I mean, that's what Bill said. You know, normally short-term memory works for the things that are not familiar to you. So there are other mechanisms of the short-term memory. And in this experiment, there is actually not a single indication that this persistent activity have anything to do with the short-term memory. All this says is that when the familiar picture is presented, you have this elevated rate. So some psychophysics that I will present, you will go actually directly to address this issue, whether you can somehow show that this long-term memory has any influence on this working memory. Okay, but from here, this is just a recording. So it could be that if you remove this area completely, the monkey would do exactly the same in this experiment. So that's something that...
What the activity increases also in the second picture?
Well, there is always, this neuron tend, this is still a visual area here. So the neurons tend to respond to almost any visual image that is presented.
Uh-huh.
So this is the immediate response, and then this is not. I will show you a little bit, actually my next slide, the examples when the neuron doesn't have this, only has a persistent activity, but no visual response. But generally, I guess if you are in the visual area and you show something complex, neurons tend to respond to it. It is immediate.
The idea is that only those who are related to this specific memory.
Right, then they will remain, you know, active for this.
The activity goes off once the monkey responds to that target, right?
It's an interesting thing, you know. There was some studies by the group of Charl Hochstein in Jerusalem that actually between the trials, if you read the activity here, you can see the trace of the previous. So it's not completely independent.
Michel, is there a way to experimentally distinguish between whether the monkey remembers the thing for the 16 seconds or whether the input is just launching some sequence of thoughts? Some activity, you know, some dynamical activity, and that the monkey has completely forgotten what launched it.
Well, if the monkey is forgotten, then it wouldn't be able to do the task. So clearly the monkey remembers what picture was presented. The task is that you have to, when the monkey sees the second picture, has to compare it with this one. So at least for this you can be sure. Okay. So what I mostly want to address, you know, one of the things that I think is potentially very interesting, you know, subject for the study is to see, you know, what happened if you try to remember things that are not completely unrelated to each other, right? Which is obviously what we always do. So one of the issues, for example, is how these relations are represented themselves. Imagine that you somehow manage to remember things that are correlated, but you know, how these relations between the memories are themselves represented. For example, there are lots of different relations, time relations. We remember things in a certain time order. We remember, you know, who are our friends, who are our enemies. You know, everything that we remember comes with a lot of strings attached, you know, coming from everything else. And this this model doesn't give an answer to this question, you know, how do we know, even if we manage to retrieve a certain memory, how we retrieve also all these other strings that are attached to it. Of course, you can say everything is included in this pattern, right? There are certain dedicated units that tell friends from enemies, you know, but this, if it's not a very elegant idea. And if you think about how many different relations any particular memory has, it's somehow hard to imagine that everything is included directly into this. So another idea is that this relation somehow change this representation in a certain way, you know, not to provide the explicit units that code for certain relations, but by changing the correlations between these attractors. All right, so for example, one of the things that we did about 10 years ago with Dani Amit and Nicola Brunel is to explain some experiments coming from Miyashita group that had the monkey doing this experiment. But during the training, the pictures that the monkey was seeing were always presented in the fixed order. So it was not these P memories were ordered. There was a certain meaning to this label. So new was going from 1 to about 100 pictures were memorized by the monkey in a certain order. And then when the recordings were done, the pictures were presented in completely random way. So it was some fractals. So there was nothing, no similarity between the picture that was somehow captured by this ordering here. But despite of this, when the recordings were made and the monkey was doing this sample to match to sample task and the recordings were made, the result was that the representations of this picture were sensitive to this order. So if the neuron was selective to a certain picture number mu, there was a higher probability that it was also selective to mu plus 1 and mu minus 1. So for few neighbors here, up to 5, there were if the neuron was responding in this delayed way for picture number mu, it was also responding to few of the neighbors. Right? So this tells that if you translate it into this picture of the population state, of this vector states, it would mean that the representation, the attractors, that represent memories which are neighbors in this sequence, they become more correlated. There is a high overlap between them. And so the idea could be that this is how the temporal information is stored, right? So it's reflected, it's translated into the correlations between these attractor states. And the way we try to explain it is just by adding here an extra term that mixes up the memories that come one after another. So show that it's enough to add just one term, one extra term, which mixing the neighboring patterns or symmetric version of this So for a carefully chosen number A, you can see how the model generates the attractors that are now some specific combinations of this pattern. So now every attractor is not a pure pattern anymore, but it's a certain combination of neighboring patterns. And as a result, the attractors corresponding, which I evoked by presentation of these patterns, become correlated. And there is also, so this is, if this picture is true, then what happens when the monkey is seeing the picture, the particular picture number mu, what happens is that first, if you could follow the activity in time, what you would see that first the pattern that corresponds to this pure picture is evoked in the network, and then due to this intrinsic dynamics, the activity changes so that eventually some certain mixture of patterns is created, and this will become a representation. There is some recordings, you know, anecdotal, that support this. This is my second image, where you see sometimes the instances where there is no direct correlation between the visual response and the delay activity. So you see here these four cases where the delay activity and the response are not directly related. You have it, for example, a neuron that doesn't respond to the first picture, but during the course of this delay activity, it's presumably recruited by other neurons, right? And then it participates in the delay activity, and vice versa. You have a neuron that responds very strongly, but, you know, is not supported by other neurons, presumably, and then its activity decays, so it's not participating. Usually, you know, you just throw out the trials where there are mistakes. It's very interesting. If I had, you know, access to this data, the first thing I would do is try to correlate the performance of the monkey with, you know, these kind of things. And okay, now let me go to what I'm doing now. This is all still old stuff. So the motivation for our project the current project is twofold. So first, I wanted to explore this idea further about how the relations between the memories could affect the representation. And second, precisely, you know, follow-up of this question is whether we can design some experiments which would show that, you know, these changes in the representation somehow affect the perception, the memory behavior. And since we are not doing electrophysiology, so we designed some psychophysical experiments together with Dovsagi, as a psychophysics lab, visual psychophysics lab in our department. So what I want to see is what happens if you try to remember things that form a continuous, you know, transformation from each other. So the problem that I try to solve is that imagine you have you create two memories that are initially uncorrelated, and then you try to remember them together with the sequence of patterns that somehow gradually go from one to another, right? So you create patterns psi I mu, for mu now can be a continuous index between 0 and 1. So it's a gradual transformation that goes from one to another. Okay, and the way I realize it is that it's very simple. Since I have these binary patterns, I will describe only the simple case where you have this binary patterns. What I do is effectively is I just look at for every neural number I look at these two numbers. If they agree with each other, then I just leave it for all the intermediate patterns. So I say, okay, let me write it. So I have two cases, right? If psi I zero equals psi I one, then I say psi I mu equals psi I zero for all mu. So I just don't touch it. If there is a mismatch, then at certain time I just flip it, right? So I correct. I consider this as a mistake. So I flip it at the random moment. So I have a certain random number mu star, which is between 0 and 1. And I flip it. So I say before this, my pattern is the same as the source. Let's call this source and target. So this is like a source. So psi I mu equal psi I zero for mu less than mu I star. and it's equal psi of 1 for mu, which is below. Okay, so this is how I, just for the purpose of this study, I create these patterns. Right, so there is no deterministic way. If I do the same procedure twice, I will come up with two different passes which go from the pattern number 1 to pattern number. But I do it just once, and now I treat this as my memories, and I want to see what happens if I try to remember them in the, with this Hopfield mechanism. So I now put them in the same, so I leave this recipe. As is.
Sure.
Yes.
So two questions. For the first part, it might be the case that the neuron is flipping twice. So
no. Okay, so I don't allow this. I just say if there is a match between these two patterns, then this neuron will just remain active.
And would it be possible to use a continuous transformation from one
state? Well, it becomes almost continuous. If I have a lot of neurons and many patterns, it becomes effectively continuous because every time I flip just one neuron out of n.
No, I mean for a single neuron. Does it make sense to think of it of
not in this model where the neurons have a binary binary values, right? So you cannot have them. In some other realizations where the everything here is continuous, I could think of just linear interpolation, for example. But in this case, I cannot. The only thing I have is just to define the moment where I flip, correct this mismatch.
So the correlation between the pattern grows linearly in time?
Right. So this guarantees that if I look at the overlap between different memories, like psi mu and psi nu. This will be 1 minus modulus mu minus mu. Okay, so it will go like this. Okay, so the question is now what will happen? So I have this, everything is now well defined. I have this pattern that are generated in this way, and then after I generate them, I fix them, so I don't have any randomness anymore. Everything is deterministic. I have this matrix. I want to see what happens if I present different patterns, whether this network will remember what it will actually remember. And this is a very simple thing, because I can just do the same standard calculations that people did with the Hopfield model. And just to give you an idea how this is usually done, again, I assume, if I say that I have a state, certain state S, then at the next step, I had it already, but I erased it by mistake. So you had an input to the neuron I, which is expressed in terms of the overlaps. So if I, at time t, I have a state with overlaps m with all the neurons, then at the next time, this will be my input. So if I know this overlaps in time t, I know the inputs at the next time, so I can compute now the activities of all the neurons at the next time. So from here, I can, again, using my definition of the overlaps, I can compute the overlaps with all the patterns at the next time. So I have a equation that relates that translates these dynamics in terms of the activities of single neurons into evolution of the overlaps. And then I can use my definition of these patterns to see what happens if I begin with a particular state and what will happen. So for example, what happens if I begin with one of the memories? So if I have overlaps that look like this, right?
I'm a little bit confused. So there are only two patterns, right? So the network was exposed to only two patterns.
No. It's exposed to all this sequence. Yeah.
So there is an integral there.
There is an integral.
It's not a sum, it's just an integral.
Well, if it's infinitely many patterns, then it's an integral. If it's but finite, then
patterns,
it's...
zero and one, there are only two of them. There are no other pairs.
Right, you could add some other unrelated patterns to this, but I didn't put it here. I just consider if you only try to remember this particular sequence. So what you can show is that just by the construction of this matrix and the rule that I used to generate these patterns, you can just prove that the only stable configuration of the overlaps looks like this. So if this is mu going from 0 to 1, this is 1 half, this is 1. Okay, so this is the only solution to this equation, right? If you want to a steady state, then it's always has to look like this, which means that the only attractor state of this network is the middle point, right? It's a pattern which is, so the attractor state is psi I 0.5. Okay, so this is a very simple prediction of this kind of model. So no matter where you begin with part number 0, part number 1, or anywhere, you converge very quickly to the part number 0.5.
But is this the truth? You clump them saying square root of n, so instead of having n a sequence with n, you have a sequence with square root of n.
No, I don't have a square. It's true for any p that is bigger than 1. It doesn't have to scale with n. So I actually had to assume that p is big by it finite and n is goes to infinity, then that's what it is. So this was your question?
Yeah, but I don't know, because the reason why you have only this one maximum is because they're very correlated.
Right. So if p is finite, you may have two possibilities. You may have like three or two, which are neighbors here. But if you have very many patterns, then the distinction between these neighbors is almost negligible.
Right, but if you have p is, say, square root of n, doesn't it look really like the case where you have patterns that are uncorrelated? That's what I don't understand.
P square root of n is fine. You will only have then one pattern here in the middle.
Yeah, so I don't understand why you don't have many.
Why don't I have many?
Yeah, because if you have only square root of n patterns, even if you...
Well, I said to you that I can actually solve the case with finite p. And then then the true result is that you don't have one attractor, but you have three, let's say.
Rather, if he sampled the mu axis with only square root of n points,
right,
then the correlation matrix of the patterns would nonetheless have this triangular form. It's just that it would be discretely sampled. So by lowering the number of sampling points along the mu axis, you don't decorrelate the patterns, right? Because all the patterns are composed by something like, well, the discrete analog of linear combinations of two things. So, no, you can't, right? You're on a line. And if you're moving on a line, and you take discrete samples along the line, the vectors still point in the same direction, right?
No, but they're still be correlated, but the steps, if you want, in the correlation will be much larger.
Well, they're still not much larger.
What makes them work is the absence of correlation, not large differences in correlation.
No, but you only have, even in random network, you only have some correlation, it's just by accident. So if you have...
Yeah,
if
but it's making the network large, so...
It's one of the square root of n.
I would have to, yeah, but that's what I'm saying, exactly. So if you choose square root of n, then you get the same. Okay, I'm not convinced.
Sorry, I can't answer because I don't really see what's... Okay, so this is basically my result from this theoretical analysis. I can do it a bit more realistic. I can consider the sparse memories, but... And then I have a little bit more complicated thing when it's not just the middle point, the attractor, but some combination of the patterns in the middle. But the basic result is always the same, that if you prepare your network in this way, and these are the patterns that you try to remember, you cannot really remember each one. You don't have like a line attractor where you could have any pattern as a stable state. You always have one of them, which is either the pattern in the middle or some combinations of the pattern in the middle, but always one. So this would mean that in a certain sense, it's a failed system. It cannot really remember all these things. Instead of this, it remembers just one representative of this. So,
if I can ask Rava's question in a slightly different way. So maybe part of the problem is that he has this very specific algorithm for generating the overlapping patterns, right? But what if you take p patterns in this n-dimensional space, right?
Yes.
And you generate them all initially at random, so white noise patterns or whatever, you threshold them. And then you take every n over pth one, so every n over pth entry of each pattern, and then do the assigning, right? then you have these patterns that are more spread apart. The correlation is going to be smaller, and the correlation size is going to be something like what Rob was hoping for.
Yeah, but that's I did this on purpose. I wanted to have a pattern that more or less continuously go from one to another. That's what the whole purpose of this exercise.
Ah, but the question was, what if you have
you can create other sets of patterns,
yeah.
And then of course the result would differ. I wanted to see what happens if there is a continuous transformation from one pattern to another. Yes.
How sensitive is one peak to having full connectivity matrix?
My bet is that it's all of these details are actually not relevant. You can have a very different realization that you have more or less the same. But it's sort of, you have to do a lot of studies to really prove this.
Can I ask the last question? So if you go from one pattern to the other,
take the sequence of questions.
If you go from one pattern to the next, you lose correlation by a factor of 1 over n.
Right.
So that's the
one
amount
over
that
n.
Throughout.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, if you clump.
No, no, 1 over p.
Yeah,
because in p steps, you go from one to another.
Right,
so.
But in this case, p is n, right?
No?
No.
P is not
alpha
n.
Times n.
P is a big number, but let's say it's 100.
Okay, it's alpha times n because
alpha
some of them
n.
Are.
Alpha
it's not alpha times n, it's just
okay.
A big number.
Yeah. Okay, but if xi1 was always different from xi0, then it's n.
If it's if you create them uncorrelated, no, it still can be p. It just means that at any step of my procedure, I update a certain fraction of this
no,
neural.
If you take c0 to be all zeros, so
all zeros, okay.
And then c1 to be
all
ones,
ones,
then p is n.
No.
Why not?
P is I decide what p is. I say in advance. I have psi zero.
If you have vectors of length 1,000, you want to get from all zeros to all
ones. Ones in 100 steps.
In 100 steps.
I can do
time
it.
Every you turn over 10 of them.
You are missing something very basic. I don't quite see what. Yeah, right, it's exactly like Bill said. I just will have to update, to adjust number of flips that I do at every step, so that in the whole swing, I go from one pattern to another.
Okay.
But there is no restraint on this number, P, that it's completely in my hands.
So, very well. So, but if you choose now P to be small enough, why do you have this? That's what I don't understand. Because at some point, even.
It has to be much bigger than 3, because what I can see that if p is finite, I have exactly 3 states here in the between, which are all can be stable. So in order to treat them as 1, I have to say that my overall length is much bigger than 3, so these 3 are indistinguishable. So that's all I have to assume.
What
I can take 5.
You can take p much larger than this,
right.
And still have these patterns look as if they're morphing.
Yes.
However, have their correlation being not more than the correlation you would have if you had chosen random patterns.
No, the way I prepare them, I will always have this correlation. It's just a matter of sampling this, right? So this is the pattern which I will always have, right? This is a correlation between pattern number mu with all the rest, right? So it will always have the correlation with the neighbor where it's very large. If this is the way I prepare them, I can prepare it with some in other way. Then I will can have this in a different way. But I prepared this in this particular way because I want to see what happens when you gradually go from one to another, not by random jumps.
So I might be missing something. So basically, you want to construct a memory. So all the neighbors are more correlated to its nearest neighbors, right? So you're trying to construct as a generic one, or just?
Well, you had a certain experimental procedure in the head. So, you know, I'm describing in this order, but in fact, this was experimental study and
right,
modeling going at the same
if
time.
If you ever constructed one of this, right? You construct from some samples, eventually you have this sample. Going on just like that.
Yes.
But in the rest of the life of this animal, you don't need to do that anymore. You only need to associate whatever your random input memory, decorated one, with this pattern, like half of your new memory, half of there is this generic time correlation pattern. Then you solve the problem. Is that right? I'm not sure.
You are giving me a hard time because I don't really, I didn't understand what you're asking.
No, what I'm saying is this time flow, right? This
yes.
correlation.
It's not a time
pattern you want to create from this memory, right?
No, I want this to become memory. So I let's say I have pictures, right? I have two pictures. So I just create the set of new pictures that gradually go from one to another. And now I say this all set of new pictures, I want to treat them as memory. So I want to have a system that memorizes them. And what I say is that if I try to do it with this usual Hopfield recipe, I cannot do it because instead of memorizing each and every one of them, I will have just one stable state, which somehow now represents all of them. So if I try to retrieve any one of them, so even if I see exactly the clean version of the picture number one, if I let it run, the network will correct it, you know, in a certain, it will not be able to sustain this. It will go into the state that corresponds in this case to a middle picture.
So you are telling us this construction doesn't work.
Doesn't work for this purpose, right? This is the result. Instead of remembering every picture, it will always remember just one.
But there is a simple fix, right? So if you use periodic variable, right? If it cycles to itself.
If you just continue.
Then it certainly can't remember the one in the middle.
Right. It will remember something else, but doesn't mean that it will fix. It may still work.
This overlap will be flat.
No. You can go again, right?
There's still the question of whether the stable states would be things that had a little bit of overlap with everybody, which also represents
yeah.
failure, or there would be many solutions, there would be a line of solutions.
Right.
So
it would have strong overlap with one thing, but it could be any of them.
Right, and but then if there is a periodic variable, then there is no there is translational symmetry, right? I mean, this is an edge effect.
Well, also here you have right, there is no symmetry here. But in effect, all right.
If there is translational symmetry, then you will have a line.
Doesn't mean because it can be broken.
It could also be nothing.
Could be broken. Could be like bumper tractor, right? You have a circle liner tractor, but this attractor can be anywhere. And if you put some,
it's not broken. So if you put
it's not broken.
Right. I mean, if all news are equal. Right.
Well, you tried me to do something that I didn't do. I mean, I could solve a different problem. I agree with you.
I hope this is a question about what you actually did. Not sure. If I understand you correctly, you're saying that we have a set of many images which are quite similar to each other, and the network will, in some sense, only memorize something like the average image of all these.
Right, but it's except that they're not all similar to each other. This ending images can be as dissimilar as any others. So I begin with. But in between them, right, it gradually goes. Yeah.
But this sounds to me something which is quite reasonable to ask of a neural system, right? If I show you a set of images which are only slightly different from each other in a sequence,
mm-hmm.
then a reasonable outcome would be that you should only memorize something which is in the average, right? At least in some cases.
If you don't want to remember the average of your mother and
well,
the
mother right,
and
right.
The cook,
right? No, but it's pretty hard to present a sequence of images that averages your mother with the home.
The one that's tricky is if you think about different views of the same
right,
object,
for example.
Be related to what you're going to say next.
Right. It's not related, but for example, you can imagine that this is how you memorize the faces, right, under different viewing conditions. So you see these faces under all view conditions, which are presumably, if you look at the image that comes to your retina, is some gradual transformation from one another. And then the question is, do you want to remember this as just one face without being able to remember how it looks from all different views, or you want to still remember how this face looks from all different
views? You don't memorize all different views, right? There's evidence that you...
That's, as far as I know, it's a very big debate, and some people say one...
But that's in the other way, it's whether the way in which you achieve recognition of things from any
right.
direction, is it by remembering views or
right.
by having a freedom...
Yeah, but that's a related question. Do you have a representation for each each view, or you somehow combine it into one representation, so when no matter which view you see, you will then go and reconstruct this prototype which now represents this face under all view conditions. That's a related question, but I don't know.
There are two questions of discussion here. One is, if I present a series of views, what do I do with the network so that I can remember everything? And then there's the other thing,
which is, under some circumstances, is this behavior perfectly reasonable, which is the issue that you raise. And indeed, under some circumstances, it may be perfectly reasonable. You may not want to remember all the different details that are different from these things. So indeed, there are maybe some cases.
Well, I'm quite happy with this stage of the discussion now, because that's now I'm going to do.
But your goal is indeed to find something that remembered many different things.
Yeah. Well, my goal was to see what happens if you try to do this way and see, you know. I'm quite happy with this conclusion, that it's very reasonable to expect that you are not able to do what I pose as the problem. And,
I see. So since you're investigating the methodology, you win, you win. If you lose, you win.
Yeah, exactly. I'm in a win-win situation. Some degree of sarcasm, of course. But,
I wasn't being sarcastic. I was being serious. It's always good. I didn't mean to be sarcastic. I sounded sarcastic.
Okay, so now I want to say the following. So let's say we take it seriously now, not like some exercise, but really seriously. We say that's how the system really works, that's how the memories are represented, that's the Hopfield model is actually how you try to remember them. So the prediction then is that if you have these sequences of memory that go one into another, you cannot remember them. You will always remember some one representative. And this can be a testable thing, because if this is indeed true, then in any long-term memory test, if you do on these images, you cannot distinguish one from another. If you give sufficiently long time, if you really manage to access this long-term memory and design a test that tests that actually measure this long-term memory, then in any behavioral test, you shouldn't be able to distinguish this. So it's very, very strong prediction. So we want to see if you can design an experiment to test this. So this is an idea. So we have a set of faces.
The answer clearly depends on what domain you choose, because I can remember whether I was looking at you from the left or the right.
Right. So, but we'll be happy even if
you
say that.
You look exactly at the two extremes.
No,
right? You're not.
No, there's also behind. And
no,
right.
No, what I'm saying is
if
that
I were a professional portrait photographer, I'd probably be able to remember that I looked at you from 22 degrees and not from 35.
Right. The question is, well, will you be able to draw my face from all possible views or not? But it's more or less the question. Let's say I'm asking you, how does my face look if you look from here? Do you know or don't you?
What you can do on, say, Photoshop, where there are some kind of software, is to have two pictures, two faces, and then more whole, continuous transformation from one face to another. And you are saying that I should not be able to distinguish two edges of this.
So let me do this, and then we'll see. So by the end of the talk, you will know.
Misha, I'm missing the big picture. You are saying we can only remember one thing, right? That's your conclusion, right?
Right.
If you want to verify experimentally.
Right.
But I mean, I can remember more.
Yeah, yeah, well, so of course. Of course, the question is, you say you can remember many things.
Yeah, I mean,
even if they're continuous. On the big scale, well.
But I mean,
not of them are formed, forming these continuous lines from one to another.
Why not? I mean, there's a continuous line in time. Having visual input. So
yeah, but these memories cannot be all, put onto one line with a very small change from one to another. So your memory system is not one big line of items that are going slowly from one end to another end.
Why not? I mean, I have a continuous, view.
You have these pieces that are, but, if you remember how your friend looks like and how a certain animal looks like, there is no continuous.
Well, my friend never comes to me. Jumps out of blue. It's always continuous change.
Luckily.
I look at you, and then eventually I turn my head, and they're all going slowly, and then turn into a.
But you don't remember everything here. You don't remember all the intermediate, this unrelated, unreasonable.
But still, on a big scale, it's a continuation of small changes.
I
your conclusion is at the end, I can only remember one thing. That's all.
I think, at least the message that I took away. So you can continue and get to the end of the talk, was that indeed, according to this model, that would be the case. You do not remember small variations. You don't remember very, very, very many images that have small differences from each other. For such things, you store that in a different way. Maybe you store one example, and then you use transformations in the head or something like that to think of different views, but if they're very different things, you can remember them. At least that's what
he's yeah, also, say. Not all of your memories are stored in the same place, right? You have a area that remembers, you know, language, other areas that remember faces.
Still,
it's not all one big, huge network that you just throw there, like in the basket.
Accumulation of change.
Exactly. Yes.
No, wait a second, wait there. So, I think that part of the problem is, of course, you started with an example in which the way you build the correlations is precisely in time, which kind of leaves the door open for Dawi's question. But I guess the point is that in a construction where you actually morph one thing into another along as continuous a path as you can make in this discrete space, then this correlation function really is a description of all the correlations. The correlations in time among the things that you see or hear, it might be true that if you compute some low-order correlation function, it looks more or less the same, but of course there are higher-order correlations in which there are actually discrete breaks, right? New objects
that
do
tell you that you are doing something new, right? If you
new objects do appear in your field of view, they may not, they don't appear suddenly in the middle, hopefully, but they do. I mean, you're not always looking at the same things. And so there are markers to tell you that you should separate them. I mean, it's not trivial to actually do that, of course.
Right.
What about line attractors, like, you know, something that Sebastian's talking about?
I can discuss then what the relation between this. Yeah.
What happens if instead of a line you have a plane?
I don't know. I didn't do it. This is just things that I'm really, I'm wanted to share, you know. Ongoing.
All those cases are the same, right?
So the way we took some data set which consists of British male faces, and then we actually removed all the hairs. So we make this very difficult. We even went even further on to we removed all outliers, and we actually made some pre-processing on them.
People?
This, okay, so why they look so similar is that we actually we had a set of, like, I don't remember, 100 or 200 faces. We took one of them, we morphed it to all the rest, and we took the middle points here. So this all faces are brothers. There is a set, the all common father to all of them, and we have this all faces that are brothers. Okay, so that's why it's difficult, right? No, this is partially because the computer screen is not very good, but it's a difficult task. So when you see this, we also flash them. So the subjects see, never can explore them. They see these flashed faces. Okay, and so the basic task is that, you know, as far as subjects are concerned, they have only one task during the whole study, is that there are many faces. Out of them, we dedicate four as the friends, and they have to remember these friends. And so every time they see a flash on the screen, they have to say friend or non-friend. So that's all they have to know.
Why did you make the task so difficult?
It will be clear why. Because we actually want to do something very dramatic, you know. And we want to change the way you remember this face. So presumably, if you take a, you know, very, very different face, it will either not work at all, or it will take maybe years, you know, until you can do it. We wanted to have something that works in the time course of the experiment, which is, you know, 2 weeks maximum. So, and this is, the experimental part is going forever, more or less. So it took us very, very long time to actually to fall into the protocol that really produces the results. So I cannot say what happens if you do something else. But I can show you something that
seems
to. Are you
going to flesh out,
So every time you flesh.
This construction and your.
Right, right, exactly, yeah. So what we do then, so we give them 2 days to just remember, right, to do the task so that they stop doing mistakes. And we help them at the beginning, we give a feedback, we let them explore these friends. So many people can, in 2 days, do the task perfectly without any mistake, right? So that's a proof that this is the people, not everyone, so the ones who fail, we just don't continue with them. I can try it with you, you will for sure. The very good correlate is the gender here. So most of the girls that we tried actually managed to do it. So the very good chance is that if you try this.
A very big cultural effect.
You do it
women.
Cultural effect. You do faces which are women,
yeah.
Male faces, who would do it really?
We didn't try it yet, but it's all on the pipe. So I would almost 99% sure that you will manage to do it. You can do it. Okay, so after they remember this, what we do is we take one of these friends and we do it in advance. So we have a, this is basic task. Friend, we call it F and F. So you have a face flashed, you say it's friend, not friend, then you have a certain mask, then another friend. And that's basically all you have to know. Because the subject thinks that all we are studying is how well they remember these friends over the course of the study. None of them know that we are tricking them. So now we have prepared in advance a morph sequence. So we took one of these friends and we morphed him into some other phase. And we have 100, or usually we have 50 intermediate phases here. So then what we do is when they come, what they see is a lot of faces flash, some of them friends, some of them non-friends. Then they're not going in the certain order, right? Every day it's a random order. But what we do is every time we are supposed to show him a friend, we show a next one, then the next one, the next one. So over the course of the day, what he actually sees is this sequence of these faces, right? And what happens is, of course, that at the beginning of the sequence, he still believes it's a friend, so he says yes. Somewhere at the middle of the sequence, he realizes that this is not friend, so he says no, no, no. So typically in the first few days, he says yes, 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 and no, no, no. So this is what we do. Okay, this is just an example of two pairs that we consider.
Sorry, and so you go through the sequence each day?
Every day, yeah. We begin from, in this version of the experiment that I will tell you about, you every day you begin from the first, the friend, and end up with a non-friend. Okay, this is how we measure the performance. So we just bin this into a steps of 10 faces, and we count how many times you said friend for each bin. And so there are at one, there are first 10 faces, and 10 means that all 10 times the subject said its face, because they really know the task well. So if you show them the friend or almost friend, they will always remember. They don't, this background rate of error is very, very slow. So it's we follow this during the course of the experiment just to make sure that they don't gradually, forget everything. And
what is the proportion of friends versus non-friends?
So there are four friends and about 50, 60 non-friends.
The number of times you show.
Well, every time, as usual, you do it such that the probability that it's a friend is about 1/2.
You cannot use, a subject cannot try to estimate the frequency with which a friend or non friend occurs and some use it as a prior, which would bias him towards saying friend or non friend.
There are almost no mistakes here, so it's clear, absolutely clear for us. And I actually once went through the whole procedure. It's absolutely clear that what you do, you just recognize the friend and you say friend or non friend.
But
you don't do any sophisticated.
That the guy biases his decisions by, if he knows that 90% of the time he gets friends.
It's 50%. Always like this. Half chance that you see a friend and half time that you don't see a friend.
When you show the morphing friend, did you also show the other friends?
Yeah. You see a lot of faces. Right. Yes, you hold all four friends,
but
all 50. One of them is morphing.
And what's the difference between green and blue?
It's just different days. So what we see here is that, let's say the first day, this is your performance curve, right? So up till the phase number 40, you don't notice that it's actually a different phase. So you say yes. Here you suddenly realize that it's not the same. You begin to say yes. Here you are a bit confused. So sometimes you say yes, sometimes no. Towards the end, you say no with 100% chance. Okay. So it's very nice for us because we can really follow. In the earlier versions of these experiments, they were designed in this sample-to-match version. We couldn't really follow what's going on, so we didn't know when to stop. Here, what's very nice is that every day you know where the subject is. And different subjects can progress with completely different speeds. Some of them, I didn't yet tell what happened, so let me first continue. So now, if we follow this from one day to another, then we see that for some subjects, this curve begins to move to the right. And so eventually, after about two weeks, you say yes for all of these faces. Okay, so every time you see one of these faces, you say yes. So this by itself doesn't actually mean anything because we don't really know when you say, if you see this face and you say it's your friend, we don't know really what you mean. Do you treat them as a different friend? Or do you think that it is exactly the same friend as this one? We don't really know. So we consider this as a training which is the one, you know, which has to be followed by a test, which looks at your long-term memory. And so the long-term memory test, by definition, has to involve a bigger intervals of time than this, because this is all done in half an hour. So to do the long-term memory test,
how many phases?
You see every phase, so every phase you see about 100 times, and you have around 50 phases. So a lot. A lot of it. It's pretty demanding. But they're paid, so. This is first a summary of this stage. So, as I said, not everybody is managing this. So there are some subjects that... So what we do to quantify it, we just define a threshold. So we put somewhere a threshold of where you switch from yes to no. Right, so in this case, the threshold will be around 5, a middle point. Just compute the area here. And so we can follow from one day into another what happens with the threshold. And you see there is a very clear separation. Some subjects just don't get it, right? So they are stuck here. They kept recognizing that when you go from a certain point in this sequence, it becomes a new phase, so they say no. And if anything, they actually improve. So there is certain perceptual learning here, where their threshold is actually improving. They can now see more clearly the differences.
And during this process, the feedback is off.
No, there is no feedback here.
So when you say they don't get it, you mean they choose not to.
They choose not to.
There's no sense in which.
No, there is no sense.
There's no right answer.
They actually, none of them knows about this morph. Right. You know, when you ask them later, they say it's the same faces all over. So we know that they don't get it because they just don't continue.
No, they even get it is the wrong word. They don't choose to do this, right?
They don't choose to do it.
There's nothing in the task that tells you what the right.
Right. Right. Now, our assumption is that even those that who do it, that not that because they intentionally choose to please us, because they really, you know, there is something going on in their brain that led them to do this. But of course, you know, the problem with psychophysics is you never really know what's going on. So it could have to exclude the possibility that somehow subconsciously they really know that's not the right phase, but they still say yes for whatever reason that we cannot control. And you know, there is a certain series. If you go from left to right and then back, this falling point is not exactly at the same time, but surprisingly, it's almost very negligible. So there is a certain effect of this procedure. So if you go from one phase to another, because it goes in a certain order, you keep saying yes for a little bit longer, but it's really not the main effect here. Yeah. It's very weak effect. One, we sometimes follow, we do it by, in the first day we go back and forth, and we measure this curve, and it's almost the same. Although it's systematically, there is always a little bit of hysteresis.
Is there some initial period when they're doing the task with no feedback and there's no morphing?
In the initial task, we give them a feedback just that they know who are the friends or not, because it's a very difficult task. So if you, they first see the friends, but it's not enough. If you just see the friends, then you still do a lot of mistakes. So just to train them, first 2 days we give a feedback, and there is no morph there. It's just a stage to remember who the friends are.
But then is there another period with?
And then there is a much longer period when there is no feedback anymore, and then we do the morph.
Okay.
So for those who always say yes, the one on the top, did you try afterwards to just show them a random sequence of the?
No, we didn't do, but I think we do something stronger. So what we do is, first of all, sometimes we try to go from on one day they begin from here and they always say yes also. So, but the real test is this long-term memory test. So the way we do it is, I don't have a picture. So what we do, sorry, but it's actually very easy. So what we do is we change the task. So now when they are done with this training, we come, we show them just one face, we flush it, and then we say, remember this face, right? So it's like a lineup, right? So you see, you are a witness at the crime scene, so you saw a guy, you say, remember him, then you go away, you come back several days later, and then we do a lineup. So the lineup, we don't show this, we show many faces, other friends, we show new, completely new faces, we show this one. And then the task now is to indicate when do you see the face that you saw several days ago. And we require that that you do it consistently. So we don't stop until you say 6 times on the same face. If you don't do it, then we go down the most.
But you never show the actual face.
We never show the actual face. So why we do it? Because there are some mistakes. So sometimes you can see another friend and say yes on him. So unless you do it six times, we just consider it as a random error. Because this is, again, difficult. You see a flash. It's several days ago you saw this face. You don't really very well distinguish them. So there are always like few percent of mistakes. But the chance that you will by randomly say six times on a particular face, yes, it's very, very low. Never happens.
You only show the last one. You never show, say, three or four.
Okay, I'll explain exactly what we do. So for many people, so we have now overall six observers that get to this stage. Out of these six observers, four said six times on this, so we didn't have to do anything else. Right? So they saw this face six times, they said, this is the same guy. So for those who didn't, so you do a mistake, let's say it's enough to say five times, you say yes, once you say no, then we just go down a little bit. We do like a staircase method to see where do you really stop. So even those who didn't say yes here, they say yes like here or here. So it's basically, we believe it's just a random mistake. So it's summarized here. So we have six observers. Four of them said yes at the target. So they were perfect for us, right? They really said that this is the same face as we had. One was a little bit below, so we think it's a random. And one, something happened to him. It's really, he went all the way down. So it's as if he now realized that what he was saying, that we were fooling him. So we have one outlier here. But these four, or actually five, I think are more or less perfect, especially if you compare it with the performance at the first day. What was the first face at the first day when they noticed that it is not a friend? You know, for this one, it was very, very low. So he was very good at the beginning, but at the end, he was almost perfect. These four were perfect, and then this one is apparently something, you know, didn't work properly.
Sorry, the point of the slide is that the ones who actually did well on
this four did perfect.
More friend as the friend. These guys actually thought it's the same.
Right. They were sure that this is exactly the face that they saw.
Okay. They didn't learn a new friend. Yeah.
Right. They didn't learn a new friend. They remember them as well. So we say this is a. So we managed somehow, you know, to do something very dramatic, right?
But because do they know? I mean, maybe they just don't expect that they can learn, that they can be new friends in the process, right? Because you started them out with four.
But
friends.
For this test, we don't really. Okay, you are saying that maybe unconsciously they somehow convince themselves.
The task,
yeah.
You know,
they convince themselves. That's a big problem, you know, with this kind of experiment. That it's hard to rule out what they really believe. You know, all we know is that they give us the answers, these kind of answers. And then when we interview them, they say, yeah, I have four friends, and this is one, this is not, this is four. So consciously they are not aware.
The staircase thing suggests that they think it's the same, right? Just
right.
Like another friend. If you go down and they do better.
But can you tell them that in the beginning there might be more friends?
Well, we don't say them anything. We don't say how many friends are. Okay. There are. I actually know that there are four friends. We don't say them that all of a sudden they could be.
Maybe
the
reason why they project is no more space into one or two.
But there are, but these other faces also look familiar. You see, this other face, you all over you have like 50 faces. At the end, you know all of them. All of them look familiar.
All of them are friends.
But you know which one is friend, which one is not. And you remember them individually. So that's why I think there is a. No, I somehow convinced myself that what actually happens here, that they really remember them as one face, but hard to see.
So you haven't shown the first and the last, and asked them.
Okay, now wait, I have one more piece of data here. So.
What's the percentage of pixels that are changed from the first image to the last one?
I don't know. We didn't look at this.
But in your analysis, I don't see where this parameter is incorporated. So in principle, if I take your analysis, you can switch all the pixels, right? So I will get completely the opposite image at the end, And still I will not be able to.
Okay, so the way I think about it, that it's, you cannot think about this pattern that I looked at as just a pixel image of the face, because, you know, there are lots of transformations. The memory systems are very high in this hierarchy, so it's for sure that when this activity comes to this area, this is very non-trivial transformations of this pixel image. So to think about these images as directly the pattern that you try to memorize, is, I think it's a wrong.
Even if I don't make this correspondence between pixels
right.
and neurons, what it
right. So there are lots of features.
The claim is that
yes.
Even if the network will do exactly the opposite, okay, I will not be able to distinguish between these two states.
What is the opposite here?
The opposite is that every neuron is now, if it was active in the original state, now it is inactive. And
if I create these two patterns like mirror images,
completely
this will still be true that there is only right. If I have sufficiently many intermediate images, then this will still be true that it will merge into one representation.
At least for me, it sounds very strange biologically. I don't see how this can be. But
it's I cannot think about what is this in mirror images in this face areas, like how to imagine it could be like an oriental and a western face, or could be some, because
if the input is images or whatever it is,
right,
the observation that a specific network is I mean two states of the network are completely anticorrelated and I'm not able to distinguish between them.
Well, you may be able by learning it in a different way. I'm not saying that, you know, this particular way of learning, right.
That taking intermediate states of the network,
right.
Indeed, it will be very hard to distinguish.
Right, but you can if you, let's say, you give a more bias towards the beginning and the end of this.
So even to be more complete, if you have a parameter that controls the number of neurons,
yeah.
I mean, you have this function that sometimes some of the neurons remain the same.
Right.
But if you have a parameter that controls this percentage,
right.
Maybe it sounds more plausible that indeed you will not be able to distinguish between the two extremes. But if you don't have this parameter, you can end up with conclusions that seems a little bit strange.
If you took it that you know, I don't claim that there is no way absolutely to remember them in a different way. And you can think about it creating sorts of biases and things like that. But all I'm saying is that if you try to mix them, you know, evenly in this Hopfield metric, then the result is that they will all create one representation. Okay, now there is one result that we went a bit further that actually was really surprising to me, and I don't really like this very much. So we wanted to see if, you know, how the judgment of similarity, you know, after they are done with this memory experiment, we just tried them, we asked them to rank the similarity between faces. And we wanted to see if the perceptual judgment of these faces changed in the result of this. And, you know, the cleanest result from my point of view would be if we would see that the perceptual similarity didn't change. So it's completely memory effect. But in fact, didn't happen. What happened is that they actually perceive now these faces as more similar to each other. Now, again, with this caveat that they don't really, they cannot see them and explore them. They see these flashes, random, very sharp flashes. But still, after they see these faces flashed and asked to rank the similarity between them, they rank them as almost the same. So there is a diagonal here, which is what happens if you see the same face twice. And this is this morph pair for the subject that will manage to go to the end of the experiment. And you see there is a bright spot here which says that they now perceive these faces much more similar. This is a control for the subject that didn't do it. And then so they went through this procedure, but they didn't exhibit this morph effect, and there is no hotspot here. So presumably, I don't know really how exactly to interpret this, but you can say that.
Understand this metric such that you tested on 16.
Yeah, but we took some of them were friends, some of them, this corner is completely non-familiar, new faces, so you see it tend to be brighter on the average, because these are faces that actually look very familiar. So when you learn them, you learn to distinguish between them. But if you just...
So what you're saying is that if you take out of some sample of faces, you put the two that were the starting...
Yeah, you flush one after the... Right.
The Psi 0 and the Psi 1 representatives, and you've spent time experiencing things in between. So independent of questions about recall, mm-hmm. if I just put those next to each other,
they look well.
You'll say that, or in fact, you'll say that they're much more similar than you
right.
would have said
right.
at the beginning of the project.
Right. Right.
So in fact,
right.
I understand why you don't like it.
Right.
Because right. then it could mean that
right.
your perceptual metric has shifted right. and has nothing to do with the attractive.
Right. Metric. Right. So what I would like to do is to let them explore it, because it could still be that, you know, this random flashes somehow don't let you to really get any coherent perceptual. But you're right. I mean, I don't like it because it somehow tells that maybe all of this, even this pre-processing, you know, makes these patterns just to be the same, and then there is no, the mechanism would be complete.
I mean, it could be that adaptation of the visual system to the statistical
right.
structure of the inputs
right.
actually happens before.
Right, before the memory, okay. right.
Yeah.
But how can the other one do that?
Yeah.
You certainly do adaptation to your images.
Right.
I don't see how I can control.
How much time is it between fleshing the first and the second?
Well, it's almost about a second.
Not the 16 seconds from the actual part.
No, it's just normal. You flash, and then you push. But you have a mask after, so you erase. I don't know.
So could you
have to do something.
Could you do an experiment where you take two faces that are more dissimilar and see whether they still rate them as
so
similar? How did they do the rating for the similarity, and is that a significant number? I mean, to me, at first sight, all the faces look so similar.
Right, yes, but they learn. So you see this part is very blue. So this is from 1 to 5. You say 5 is identical, 1 is not, is very different. And you see, since they are familiar with this face, they can very well to say which one. They can rank them nice. So this is as opposed to these new faces, where really they look all more familiar, more similar to them. Yeah, but that sort of bothers me.
Nito, you've taken an experiment where the Xi0 and Xi1 are very close together, right? So you sort of just are exploring.
Well, again, I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure I agree with it, because I think after you get familiar with these faces, and if you would really look at the activity at the memory stage, they would not be the same. That's, I think, the role of this.
Why did you do it with this brothers? Why did you start with this?
Because it would probably take much longer to do this. I think.
It takes much longer this way, right?
Yeah, I think.
So that might give them more time for perceptual learning, but if you did the same.
Well, it's clear that if you see something very salient, like you have a guy who smiles, then.
Yeah.
I mean, this is.
No, I mean, like. You know,
then it's clear that you will just remember that he smiles,
no,
and then you will.
For example, of ethnically diverse or something. I mean,
right. It's very difficult to imagine how you would ever
morph. But you can morph. I mean.
You can morph, but why would you? You will never mix them up.
You
yeah. Right. So I don't know really how to think about it, but yeah.
But a clearer experiment would probably be showing two pictures, one on the left, one on the right, keeping, and asking me in a few days, you know, let me show you one picture and, you know, can you recognize whether this was this or that? And then take the same subject and let him memorize all 100 faces, the whole sequence, clearly knowing that there is, you know, there is a sequence. They're very, very close, and then showing one image and asking a few days, you know, in a few days asking an image and saying where in the sequence this image is.
You know, to tell them what's going on.
If you're serious, the guy should say, well, it was somewhere in the middle.
In the middle.
Right, I mean, if you want to test this, but probably
right.
is it clear or something?
That's what probably. I agree. Yeah, it's a good idea to see, because if you want to really to test if it's a middle point or not.
Well, close to the middle.
Or close to the middle, yeah. That's what the thing
would be. What would you recall if you know the whole sequence? If the guy explicitly knows the whole sequence?
Yeah, it's a completely different experiment. We have to think about the protocol, because we have to do it in a way that we know when to stop. It's not clear, you know, not very easy to think of a good protocol.
So. Maybe people have done this in other contexts, but if you do something like this similarity judgment, but so let's do this before you've been exposed to the morphing sequence at much length. But let's say you've been exposed to the endpoints. If I then start showing you two things that are at different distances along the morphing sequence, so, but in the middle, not the ends, but you know, I show you 20 and 40 and
right.
50 and 60 and so on. And I made this matrix, does your judgment of perceptual similarity.
Does it look like this?
Yeah.
Well, I would assume it will look like this, but there may be some jumps. I don't know of anybody who did this. It's like a typical experiment with in psychophysics, like just noticeable difference, right? You do these contrast comparisons. And what you're proposing is to do something on these faces. I don't think anybody did this. But
I was wondering as a sort of, I mean, because if what's happened here is that the exposure to this sequence of images has changed your perceptual metric, then, I mean, it might be true that it also changes the dynamics of your recall of things, but
right.
Let's just start on the perceptual right. side. Then it would actually be important to know, I mean, essentially what you would be arguing is that you used to have a perceptual metric that said, well, that, you know, you make a matrix and it would have a peak in the middle and it would die right. off to the sides. And then right. after being shown that you can sweep through these things, after a while, the peak right. would flatten out. And that by itself, I guess, would be interesting. Right?
It would be interesting. Different question. Different, right. Yes.
So, can you do these things with not with faces? I mean, there's a lot of baggage that happened in our heads about faces.
Yeah. Well, it was for us. It was just hard to think of this comparable data set of picture that would be sufficiently interesting for you to do the task. And
different pictures of water lilies where Van Gogh.
Yeah. No, to imagine having hundreds.
Dogs.
Two types of roses or something like that. You know, violet, whatever, pink and red or something like that, and then all the colors morph in the middle.
Yeah, it's just not clear that it will work, because it's very difficult, you know, with the faces we are so good at it. That's what allows us to, it's amazing how good we are at this.
But I mean, you could rely on the fact that there are things like the Isabelle Gautier, right, there are these experiments on Griebels, right, where you create these artificial objects and you gradually, with enough training, can recapitulate many of the things that happen in face perception. But of course, it takes a while, because you basically have to become as expert at this artificial, entirely artificial world as you would in the world of faces.
Right, and then they have months, I'm sure they have months of training.
Maybe you don't want to be an expert in this task, right? Because maybe if you're an expert, it's not actually a one-dimensional sequence to you. You think you're changing it along one dimension, but maybe there is some...
Yeah, but the problem is that he needs to be able to move from one thing to another continuously and have sort of signal to noise ratio be an issue, right? Because that's sort of another set of questions. So if you were in a domain where you tend not to make where fine distinctions aren't helpful for you, then many of these things will simply be called, many of these steps along this continuum are just going to be called the same by most observers.
Well, I mean, you can test at the beginning of the experiment.
Designing something in line drawings where you have the screen and you have, let's say, you know, circles and squares and triangles arranged in a certain pattern, and then you just sort of move the pattern along. And let's say in the beginning they're sort of kind of separating, and in the end they're kind of together, right? And that's clearly different, together versus being separated. But if you present a sequence where they're moving slowly, then that you can clearly sort of bring them together with one parameter, which is the mutual separation or something.
I could think of some pictures like this sort, with some geometrical shapes which move or just go from one to another.
So, but at the end of the day, I guess the point you're making is that certainly in this test, leaving aside the possible issue of the change in perception metric and things like that, one would take this as a sort of preliminary evidence of if you continuously move along some continuous direction, then the way you tend to remember things is by sort of taking the average.
But under some conditions, right, the generic thing that happens is that it's clumped into one, yes.
Is there anything that said in your experiment that says anything about the shape of this curve?
No. Okay. We have to do this.
What if you change your recall process from the sign to something else, say a linear function with bounds, of course, and then your recall process changes your conclusion here, you draw on the board, linear combinations of memories, right? For example, one way of morphing the images.
Right.
And then they might become stable equilibrium.
Yeah, maybe. I didn't do it.
Interpretation of
right, of course. Yes, of course. I hope that this conclusion was sort of robust. Many things about Hopfield model turned out to be extremely robust if you implement them differently. So I'm just hoping, you know, that also this conclusion. But I have to do it. Thank you.